from the screen.
May it please the court, my name is Iris McCollum Green, and I represent the appellant Susan Peavy, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case deals with whether the United States Postal Service's denial of a hearing prior to termination of a 23-year employee is precluded from judicial review. Title 39, Section 10B of the Postal Recovery Act of 1970 mandated that the Postal Service establish a procedure whereby employees and officers of the Postal Service were assured the protection of their employment rights and guarantees of fair hearings in cases of adverse action. Pursuant to that mandate, the Postal Service established the Section 652.2 of their Employee Labor and Relations Manual, which states that an employee may submit a written request for a hearing within 15 days of receipt of notice of an adverse action. In this case, on April 29, 2011, the Postal Service sent two letters of notice of adverse action to one to Ms. Peavy and one to her counsel. The letter also informed them that she had 15 days of receipt of the letter to submit a request for a hearing. Ms. Peavy complied with that directive and submitted a request for a hearing 15 days after receipt of the notice of adverse action. Through the Postal Service's erroneous determination of the date on which Ms. Peavy's attorney received the decision letter, the Postal Service rejected Ms. Peavy's request for a hearing as untimely. The district court had jurisdiction to hear this dispute. Both Ms. Peavy and her counsel received the decision letter on May 2nd. Ms. Peavy submitted her appeal and request for a hearing on May 17th, which was the 15th day after receipt of the notice of decision letter. Subsequently, on May 24th, the Postal Service issued a letter in which it rejected Mrs. Peavy's request for a hearing as untimely, terminated her employment, and informed her that she had no further right of appeal. The Postal Service contends that Ms. Peavy and her counsel received the decision letter on Saturday, April 30th. That's simply impossible. Ms. Peavy's counsel has submitted an affidavit under oath stating that her office is closed on weekends, that there is no one present at her office on Saturdays and Sundays to accept mail, and there is no mailbox outside her office to accept mail where mail could be left even if a delivery was attempted. In Bell versus Brown, this circuit has held that since receipt and not mailing is expressly made the inaugurating event, the applicable period begins to run from the time the notice comes into the recipient's hands. With Ms. Peavy's request for a hearing being rejected as untimely, she has been denied access to the only forum of redress available to her as a non-preference eligible accepted service employee. Accordingly, Ms. Peavy has also been denied the opportunity to exhaust her remedies, her administrative remedies. This is a denial of her constitutional right to due process. Congress did not intend that a federal agency, through its arbitrary action, could take away an employee's right to due process of law. As a 23-year Postal Service employee, Ms. Peavy was entitled to a hearing prior to termination from her job. The Supreme Court and Webster versus Doe, citing Johnson versus Robinson, held that where Congress intends to preclude judicial review of constitutional claims, its intent to do so must be clear. This circuit has followed Robinson's instructions in a trilogy of cases.
If we got to the constitutional claims here, so in other words, if we agreed with you that it's not precluded from judicial review, why is it unconstitutional to have this kind of, I don't know the term, delivery rule, mailbox rule, as opposed to the rule that you're seeking?
Well, this court has in its own decision in Bell versus Brown decided that when the triggering event is expressly stated, that receipt, not mailing, is expressly stated, it's when the individual recipient receives the mail in hand. Now, it's been argued the Postal Service's position was...
I think your due process argument, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that it's a violation of due process to have a different rule, that its receipt is actually when it was delivered rather than when it was opened. And the question I have is, I think we have a case, Lepre, and some others, why is that unconstitutional? I think it's not great practice. I agree with you to the extent you're saying that.
No, the unconstitutional, argument regarding the denial of due process of law is the fact that she was denied a hearing based on the Postal Service's erroneous determination of the date on which she received the letter.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that was my understanding, so I'm glad Judge Kavanaugh asked this. My understanding of your due process argument is that she was denied a hearing, which they concede she's entitled to if she files a timely appeal.
There's no doubt that
receipt, this isn't about the mailbox rule or anything else. This, it's a fight over whether or not when it was received and when the 15 days ran. And you're saying, your argument is straightforwardly, we filed in proper time and yet you denied us a hearing. That's a procedural.
Absolutely. Both Ms. Peavy and her counsel contend that they received, actually not only contend, they received it on Monday, May 2nd. Ms. Peavy.
I mean, it's a straightforward fight on whether we were timely. That's the argument. It's not about what procedure would satisfy due process. About we filed timely and you denied us a hearing.
That's it exactly. Had they afforded her the hearing, we would not be here.
We would not be here. This is not about the substance. About we were simply denied a hearing and we did what we were supposed to do. And
absolutely.
You are refusing us an opportunity to have the process that we're entitled to have.
That is our argument, because our request was timely.
And I guess the difference in the Lepre case is, in that case, it was really the mailbox rule. Right?
That case was really the mailbox rule.
It was appropriate for the post office to actually have a mailbox rule. But this rule is not the mailbox rule. This rule
is the date of receipt rule.
So what you're saying is, you were told that it would be a certain amount of time from the time of receipt. And then they said, ha ha, no, it's not. You waited too long. It's not from when you received. And that's the violation of due process.
Well, what they said was, you got it on a different day. In fact, what they said was, you got it on Saturday rather than Monday, as you claim.
Right. Also, in Lepre, there was the ability of agency reconsideration and appeal. And
that's
the court
correct.
Relied on that, and there is none here.
There was absolutely none here. In fact, the hearing is the only process that Ms. Peavy, as a non-preference eligible accepted service employee, is entitled to.
Do you want to save the remainder of your time?
Yes. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Alan Birch for the United States. The essence of the claim of denial of the appeal on the basis of the timeliness is essentially a Vitarelli claim. It is the claim that the agency was not following its own procedures.
I just don't read the case the way I think you've been characterizing it. Their claim is pretty straightforward. There are rules in play. It isn't about mailbox or any other. We filed in time. you made a determination we didn't. We said we did.
Right.
And let me just ask you a question, make sure I understand your theory before you start. Do you agree that if they filed in time, right, and you said, we're not giving you a hearing, that violates due process? No. Don't take my hypothetical the way I'm giving it to you. All of you at your table agree. Everyone agrees they filed in time. Don't change my hypothetical because I'm trying to understand. She filed in time. Hypothetically.
Right. If she filed her appeal,
for a hearing in time.
Request for appeal in time.
And the Postal Service said, we're not giving you a hearing.
Then I think you would need to look at the Matthews factors because she did receive an
counsel,
audience with the...
Counsel, please. I know you all hate to do it. Indulge me. Please. She filed in time.
If she...
She filed in time. There's no variation on the hypothetical.
Right. No, I agree.
You agree. Everybody in the whole Postal Service agrees.
I accept that if she filed...
But you don't hear my question.
If she files
in time.
I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that that would violate due process.
Because?
Because she already received a hearing in April, reflected in the April decision letter. This is about an appeal of the decision that came out of that hearing.
So you mean if there is, as part of the process that you offer, a government agency, this is really illuminating for me, government agency offers process, which includes an internal procedure for an appeal, you can take it away. And that's not a violation of due process.
I think you would need to look at the Matthews factors.
You think you could take it away even though it's given unequivocally. The rules say you are entitled to an appeal as long as you do it within 15 days. Not maybe, not we'll look at Matthews. You get an appeal if you file within 15 days. Unequivocal in my hypothetical, okay? You can take it away and not violate due process? You give me a case.
Excuse me?
Give me a case where you can remove it where it's unequivocally given as part of the process.
I am not aware of a case.
I'm not aware of any case either. Okay. So you think you would agree that there is a serious question, okay? So I know you don't want to concede anything. There'd be a serious question about a due process violation, right?
I would agree it's a serious question, yes, okay. Your Honor. That I would agree with.
So
certainly.
That means this case comes down to fact-finding, right?
Does
it come down to fact-finding?
No.
They assert X, you assert Y. You say they received it on the 30th, they say they got it on the 2nd.
I think you have to address the jurisdictional issue first, Your Honor.
No, let's assume I don't have any problem with the jurisdictional issue because, as you say, it would be, so you can go with my hypothetical there too, okay? I want to get to this first, then you can go back to your jurisdictional
issue. Okay, assume that we lose on the jurisdictional issue, sure.
Right.
Okay, for the purpose of this question, then.
Let's assume that... it is as I'm suggesting. You got a factual fight, right?
Right. There's a.
And the district court decided this on 12b-1, right?
That's right.
And I guess 12b-1 and 6, right?
Well,
looked like a 12b-1 and 6.
That's right. Right. If we're assuming that the district court erred on the jurisdictional analysis,
And so you're supposed to take the facts as asserted by the other side, right?
On a 12b-6 analysis, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So then how did the district court make factual determinations on this point without doing any fact-finding? There was no summary judgment.
Well,
this isn't a review of an agency decision, so it couldn't be the district court was saying, I have to find the substantial evidence in the agency record. This is on a constitutional claim. District court's got to make its own factual determinations on a constitutional claim.
It would be permitted under, that's essentially right, Your Honor,
right.
But the analysis is there. I think that it would come down to, in the district court opinion, of the facts, and if you were to
wasn't
remand it.
Wasn't a fact-finding procedure. The whole analytical framework is wrong. The analytical framework, if you're going to do it under 12B, you assume that what's in the complaint, the asserted facts in the complaint are correct.
That's right, Your Honor.
Unless you're going to do jurisdictional fact-finding, which she didn't do.
She did not do jurisdictional fact-finding.
She didn't do any fact-finding.
No, but if you were to remand it for the court to do the summary judgment analysis, there would come into a point where it would be fair for the government to argue no discovery is necessary. The papers provide a particular factual.
Maybe.
Sure.
Maybe.
And that begs the question of whether it would be worth the effort in the remand, or whether this court could, as it sometimes does, affirm on the merits.
Affirm on the merits when there's been no appropriate and the material fact. There's a material fact in dispute with respect to which there's no proper
Your
determination.
Honor, with all due respect, on the merits, the government sees it as a legal question, as what does receipt mean? Can delivery satisfy receipt? And that's the agency's position.
There's a dispute over delivery.
Well,
they don't agree with you.
I think that the evidence that they put forward.
There isn't any evidence. There are assertions, but the district court hasn't made. We don't know what the evidence might have been if the case had played out as a fact-finding forum.
The evidence they put in simply stated, I received it on Monday.
Right, and if you accept that as true, they win. If you do what you're supposed to do in a 12B, you accept that, then they're fine.
But you need to establish you need to accept also the undisputed evidence that it was delivered to the address on Saturday. That's undisputed.
What undisputed evidence?
The evidence of the receipt of the...
You mean the stuff that you put in?
Right.
But that it's not the proper process to do that. If it's a 12B, you have to accept, if you're going to find that there are disputed material facts, then you got to go to summary judgment or trial.
Well, the evidence doesn't conflict if it can be reconciled.
It can't be reconciled.
Her evidence doesn't say that I got it from a postman on Monday. Her evidence is completely
consistent.
You're
quibbling over the details of the facts. That's exactly what the district court hasn't done yet. That's exactly the problem here.
You would need to...
We can't do this at the appellate level.
The evidence she put forward is as conclusory as an allegation, Your Honor.
What do you need to do on a complaint?
But not on summary judgment. No.
Not on summary judgment.
I thought that was the whole point of your question about...
Are you on summary judgment? Did I miss something? Did the district court decide this on summary judgment?
Your Honor, perhaps I missed...
No. We don't automatically take... What did the district court decide this on? 12B, right?
If I may, Your Honor, I took your question to be if this were a proper summary judgment analysis, had the district court gone through the proper summary judgment analysis, and your point was, as I took it, that no, the district court did not go through the proper summary judgment process. That's
right.
Where I was coming from on that. If you were to apply that standard, then you need to look at what is the difference between evidence and allegation. The only thing she has is essentially equivalent to an allegation.
Can we stick with the case as it is? There isn't a summary judgment here.
No, there is not a summary judgment
here. So we don't know what more the parties would have put in had the case gone to summary judgment. The plaintiff is entitled to rest on the complaint and what they assert with the complaint.
For 12B6 analysis, that's
okay.
That is not where the district court based its decision.
The district court was wrong.
The district court based its decision on the jurisdictional question that has preceded all of this.
How can you do the jurisdictional?
Just one fact question before we get to the jurisdictional. You said that the evidence was that it was delivered to the specific address. Is that what you said?
That's my understanding.
And where is that evidence? At least one of them was delivered in Rockville, Maryland, 20850 to 20850 carriers.
I think the letter to the attorney.
Uh-huh. Just tell me the JA page where it says it was delivered to the specific address.
Oh, I see. The track and confirm does not have the specific address, no.
So there is no evidence from the government that it was actually delivered to a specific address, is that right?
Well, I think specific evidence that has the address in it, no. But,
right.
But the confirmation, I mean, it's
confirmation
not,
just says it was delivered to mail carriers.
Well,
the one of them says...
The one on A49, the one that refers to White's copy, the... attorney says that it was delivered in Bowie, Maryland, with a zip code.
Yes, but it doesn't say at that exact address.
No,
and her position is in an affidavit that there was no place it could have been delivered exactly at that address on that day. So that seems to create a factual dispute, doesn't it?
Well,
leaving aside all the other questions you and Judge Edwards just asked, that seems like a factual dispute.
Well, the evidence of that, it's...
It could just as well mean it went to the mail carrier. There's nothing that says that the mail carrier actually...
With all due respect, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, I think the post office is entitled to a presumption that things have worked the way that they are
what day of the week
to work.
Is it? What day of the week is this?
Today is Monday.
No, what day of the week? I know what day of the week is today.
Saturday.
It was a Saturday, and it was a commercial building. It was closed. According to them, it was closed. That's perfectly consistent with the tracking order that says it was delivered to the mail carriers and that they held it until Monday to deliver it.
That's not the evidence for the white letter. That's the evidence for the PV letter.
And that one also says, is that the Bowie, Maryland one or Bowie, Maryland one or the Rockville one?
The Bowie, Maryland, A49 in the appendix. That one says it's delivered in Bowie. It doesn't say to carriers.
And it also doesn't say to the house.
No, but it doesn't say that it was delivered to the carrier. Well,
this seems like an easily resolvable dispute. You put the person on the stand, and you put the mail carrier on the stand, and you ask them each. But I don't see there's any presumption involved here. The only presumption would be as if we have to believe the pleadings of the post office.
Be that as it may, Your Honor, this is exactly why I think that the case was properly dismissed on jurisdictional grounds.
But on that, I don't really get how you could challenge this otherwise.
Yes.
And you said in your brief, the government's theory, PV may argue in her reply, that the government's theory leaves her no room to challenge the very procedure that prevented her from
exhausting.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's a hole. That's a problem for you, right? Because there's no other. How would you challenge this?
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor. But that's where we get into the jurisdictional question, and I think that's why Stedman is so lesser.
But Stedman wasn't about challenging this kind of thing where there'll never be judicial review. Say you think. You could characterize the argument here in a number of ways, but let's just say you think the way the delivery rule has been articulated here is a due process violation. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that's your claim. You're never going to be able to get judicial review of that claim because you'll either be out of time and therefore defaulted, or you will have complied with 15 days, in which case it would be moot. You'd never get judicial review of an argument that the 15-day rule as applied by the Postal Service from delivery is unconstitutional.
But the language in Stedman, I think, explains that very well because it says that a challenge to the CSRA procedures is what is barred, and that is exactly the challenge.
For certain kinds of procedures, I think Stedman would kick in. But for this procedure, you will never get, if you can tell me, how would you get judicial, how would you not comply with the 15-day rule and then get judicial review of your argument that the 15-day rule is unconstitutional?
This is why this challenge would be covered by the CSRA exclusivity. You could not bring such.
I know, but could you ever get judicial, you couldn't, is what you're saying.
Yes, wound up in the procedures
themselves. This is a constitutional argument that you're saying.
That's
we're
right.
Assuming arguendo, it's a constitutional argument that the procedure is constitutionally flawed, and if you can't challenge it in this way, you'll never be able to challenge it.
That's not right. What Stedman says.
And I don't see that in Stedman.
It's not what Stedman says.
Yeah. In Stedman, there would be other ways for you to get the challenge.
But the case law refers more broadly to situations where it's a constitutional claim, for example.
I agree. Lots of constitutional
claims.
Say there's an evidentiary rule or something and you don't like, you'll be able to kind of pursue that through the process and get it heard.
Evidentiary rule, I don't think so. The kinds that have been allowed are claims like in Andrade, for example, right. Which was to the authority of the people who authorized the reduction in force.
Right.
The challenge to there was that
they
were not properly appointed under the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That's totally unrelated to the procedures that Congress decided to provide to particular employees.
I understand, but what I'm concerned about is no review ever of a constitutional claim. Right away, your Webster v. Doe antennae go up. I think your argument is...
If not the holding in Stedman, then the logic of Stedman, I think, applies. Because the logic of Stedman, if I may, Your Honor, is about how you can very easily circumvent the exclusivity of the system.
But it's all about exclusivity in the first instance. I just highlighted every time where the court said, must first pursue, must come directly to district court, must seek relief first, over and over again.
Right.
Let me just ask you, I want to narrow this down exactly. Imagine that the agency said, tough luck, no hearings of any kind. We're just not going to ever give you a hearing of any kind. Your position is?
That would be a problem. Yeah.
And it would be a problem. Why would it be a problem? Doesn't the CSRA protect you from that? I mean, after all, the CSRA doesn't say anything about it.
Well, then I think the CSRA would have a potential problem under the due process clause.
Okay. That's not the CSRA's problem. The question is, did Congress in the CSRA intend to cut off any attack on a due process issue? And I thought your position was yes. Is that right?
No.
That was a position you took in the briefs.
Yes.
But that can't be right. That's not consistent with any of our cases.
I think it would be that what is permitted is a claim that is not related to the process that has been provided by the statute. And the process here,
she's in a process that was established
by the statute. That's why this is fundamentally a Vitarelli claim or a claim like Graham, where it's a claim, Vitarelli is a claim to that the agency's not following its own rules. And that's fundamentally the issue here, is whether the agency is following its own rules and applying its receipt rule in the manual that says 15 days of receipt.
Well,
does it
there's also
that?
An argument that the way, at least as I read it, the way all this transpired, whether it's because of the rule or because of how the rule was applied here, is a due process problem.
But it's the whole bait and switch aspect of it that is the core of her theory, and that is what illuminates why this is a claim that the agency's not following its own regulations.
It's a claim that however it happened, whether or not it violated the regulations, it's a constitutional problem to do it.
If this is consistent with the regulations, I don't know how it could be a due process problem.
Not consistent with the regulations.
Well, that's exactly her theory, Your Honor, and that's why this is a very
process is
claim.
Given. This is why you said in the very beginning, if process is given, at least you said you couldn't find a case, so you weren't aware of any case. If process is given and the government just says tomorrow, incidentally, we're not giving it to you, you acknowledge that raises a serious procedural due process challenge. That's this case. The process is given. She's saying you denied it to me. There's no case that you have cited or I'm aware of, and I went looking because I was so surprised by this. I can't find, and this is not Stedman. This is not Stedman.
I agree that Stedman does not.
The chief judge says those are exhaustion cases. She can't exhaust. She's not being allowed to.
I agree that Stedman is not absolutely controlling here, but the point is that the if in your hypothetical, the reason the agency had taken the appeal away was because it had she had not complied with the letter of the regulation, then there would be no due process problem. That's the dispute. It's a dispute about whether whether the agency complied with its regulations.
But I can give you 100 hypotheticals where the reasons given are disputed. It doesn't mean it's any less of a procedural due process violation if you're entitled to procedure and the agency says, I'm not going to give it to you.
But
then someone's entitled to ask why, and you give a reason, they say, you're wrong. They're entitled to raise that.
I think the bigger point, Your Honor, is that the whole point of the exclusivity is to foreclose cases where an employee can say the agency has violated this part of its procedure and therefore they violated due process,
which
would create an end run around the exclusivity of the system. That's the whole point of all these cases.
What happened in the Griffith case? In Griffith, there were two arguments. One, a statutory argument, the failure to remand to the arbitrator violated the regulations, and we said, nope, CSRA bars that. But the second was that the failure to remand to the arbitrator under the rules denied her due process. And we said, hey, CSRA, there's no evidence that the CSRA was meant to cut off that kind of constitutional challenge. And so we're going to hear it.
Griffith one of the Bivens cases?
No, it's not a Bivens case. It's the Griffith versus Federal Labor Relations Authority. And we've said many, many times that equitable claims, that's all she's raising here, not a Bivens claim, are not cut off. That equitable due process claims are not cut off unless, as in Stedman, there's another way to go about it, another way to get to court. There is no other way to get to court here.
Well, the cases do not all require that there be another way to get to court. That's part of the point of the CSRA, is that some employees in some categories of status and in some categories of adverse action are entitled to go to court and others are not.
Yes, but we will always distinguish between purely equitable claims and claims for money damages under Bivens in that respect.
Right, although there's language in Elgin that suggests that there's nothing in the CSRA that says that you're...
In Elgin, you were going to get to court eventually, right? The Federal Circuit.
And the court said specifically the Federal Circuit is perfectly capable of resolving this matter.
Right. It also said nothing in the text of the CSRA suggests that the exclusive exclusive review scheme is inapplicable simply because the covered employee challenges a covered action on the ground.
Right, but it was an exclusive review scheme in the context of exhaustion and of directing into a particular court.
Are you saying the constitutional claim here, I think you said a constitutional claim may never get judicial review under your theory?
If it's this entangled with the substantive...
And what case says that?
Procedures that are set forward, yes, or the underlying merits.
What case says, in this context, a constitutional claim never gets judicial review in any court? I've seen exhaustion, I've seen funneling to the Federal Circuit cases, but I'm not, and I might be missing it, but I don't think I've seen a case that says constitutional claims can be denied all judicial review, or any judicial review.
I think there was, I thought there was one.
Elgin says, like the statute in Thunder Basin, the CSRA does not foreclose all judicial review of petitioner's constitutional claims, but merely directs that judicial review shall occur in the Federal Circuit. But here your position is no review.
Fausto involved a statutory claim with no judicial review.
Right. Statutory.
Right.
Yeah. There are lots of those, and there are lots about constitutional claims getting funneled into the Federal Circuit, I think, concluding with Elgin.
I think the core of our theory...
Your theory is that the due process claim is pretty thin, but that doesn't strike me as a basis for cutting off review.
It's the entanglement of this issue with the challenge to the procedures. I mean, it just creates an end run that is inconsistent.
But it's hard to make a constitutional due process argument. So, the idea that this is going to open the floodgates strikes me, maybe you'll...
Well, on this record, Your Honor, with the disputed evidence, the weak evidence arguably on both sides, I think that it would invite a fair number of challenges to any kind of timeliness decision at the administrative level, and they could be dressed up as a constitutional challenge, and that's exactly
what I read part of the challenge here to be not just to the 15-day time clock here, but to be whether it was constitutionally appropriate to do it based on delivery rather than actual receipt. I thought that was part of the concept, at least subsumed. And that strikes me as a classic legal question that...
It is essentially the same as a Vitarella challenge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a constitutional claim. If the constitutional claim fails, then...
Because they are so intricately intertwined.
So I guess the Vitarella challenge, they're saying the reg, to the extent the reg contemplates something like this, the reg's got a due process problem.
I think that would have to be the theory, Your Honor, and that's why the Vitarelli challenge...
And if it does...
That's the proper way to look at it.
If it does have a constitutional problem, shouldn't or what evidence is that that's never supposed to get to court?
Well, I don't think it does. I mean, you can look at this court's analysis in LePray and a fortiori. I think it controls this case. But you could also even look at the PurePak case, which is cited in their reply brief, which would say that when it comes to things like the mailbox rule, you need to find in the statute that the agency could not possibly have read it this way. And that just that can't be in this case.
Well, I don't understand what the reliance on LePray is. In LePray, the court says we hold the statute does not bar judicial review of LePray's due process challenge to the mailbox rule. Does not.
It wasn't a CSRA case, Your Honor. It's an FTC case.
You're the one who brought it up. You said that's an...
It's an alternative position, Your Honor. It would control...
But that was a statute which has much more of a direct cutoff. That statute actually said no claims. This statute doesn't say that. This is an implied cutoff at best.
Right, but it's one that's backed up by a very long line of cases that find that it's exclusive, including in examples that cover constitutional claims and including other examples.
But not one so far that any of us have been able to find where you could not bring an equitable challenge to a constitutional claim in court afterwards. Not one, right? So when you say a long line.
That's right. But I think the rationale of those control here.
But every one of those cases says, don't worry, we're not saying that equitable constitutional challenges are covered.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We said that in Spagnola. Justice Scalia, who is the author of Fausto, said that in the case he wrote for us, Carducci or whatever, I can't remember.
Carducci, yeah.
Carducci. We've said it over and over again. This is one thing we're holding out. Now you're taking that one thing away, but maybe you can, but you can't do it based on our precedent.
Well, I think that the rationale of all of those cases speaks loudly about the intended exclusivity of the statute, which I think is the core issue, even under Webster.
Not with respect to constitutional claims.
Well, under the Webster standard, that is exactly it is. Webster asks, does the statute mean to take away judicial review of constitutional claims?
And the Supreme Court's never said that about this statute.
No.
Nor has this court.
No, that's right. I mean,
So that'd be a big new holding.
But the rationale, I think, is overlapping, and it points to this answer.
That's a fair point, but I think it's a fairly large step. That's why it's constantly held out. We're not doing this. We're not doing this.
But I think in this case, it can be a very small step because of the deeply intertwined nature of the claim.
Right.
That's why I don't think we're not asking the court to come up with a blanket rule that would wipe out even the exception in Stedman. And that's exactly what would cure a ruling that said when they are so deeply intertwined within the meaning of the language of Stedman, for example, then the statute means to withhold judicial review of a constitutional claim because otherwise the rationale of the exclusivity would be undermined.
What if your regulation were a real mailbox rule? What if it said, upon putting it in the mailbox, would you say she couldn't challenge that on the constitutional grounds?
I think she would.
That is, jurisdictionally, that she couldn't.
Your position has to be no, she couldn't challenge.
That's right, yeah.
Your position is she couldn't challenge that.
Well, I think that would be.
That's your position here, isn't it?
It's very close to our position here. I think it's very similar to Fornaro.
They couldn't challenge the delivery rule compared to the receiver.
Well,
I think Fornaro
is a good example of that, Your Honor, because they try to repackage their statutory claim as being one that's instead of being applied to me, I want to challenge the way they calculate benefits generally. And that's the sort of evasion that the court said, no, you can't do that. And I think that same analysis should apply in a constitution.
So if you had a rule that said mailing it in the post office is enough to put you on notice, that would be okay, right? So the Supreme Court has said in class action cases that's not okay with respect to cutting off class action claims, for example, putting it in certain newspapers, which people don't read.
Right.
So what you're saying is most of the time the post office delivers, and that's good enough for due process.
That was good enough in LePray, Your Honor. I mean,
I don't think so. I don't think that's right. LePray allowed the person to come in and afterwards and say, I didn't get it, and there was an appeals process. You don't allow that.
We didn't get that far in the analysis in Lepre because of the evidentiary differences. Lepre was dealt with a series of assumptions on the lack of any evidence at all. And here we have evidence of a delivery date. So I don't think you get to that part of the analysis in Lepre.
I actually find it hard to believe that the law is that people can lose their rights to property without ever getting notice. But when the government has a way of ensuring that they get notice, namely, you're the post office, you can ask return receipt, you can ask for that to be signed off of. You can do a lot of things that would allow to be sure that they got notice.
Your Honor,
I wouldn't be so fast to assume that it's constitutional to just say we popped it in a mailbox somewhere and that's good enough.
That's my whole point about the breadth of the ruling that we're asking for here. I think it can be a very narrow ruling that is bound up in the allegations here, and that when the claim is so intricately tied to the process that has been provided by statute, then that's where the exclusivity comes in. Otherwise, you're opening a door, I think, to allow for a much broader evasion.
Very, very narrow ruling the other way. She was promised process and denied it.
Well, that's a bait and switch theory, which I think is fundamentally
a failure.
Well,
I think it is a bait and switch. Because there is no case law says what you're saying, that is, that a person cannot have the constitutional claim adjudicated in some court somewhere. There is no such law. There's no such case.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
No, but what this case is about.
No, it's not, because those cases don't have a situation where the agency complied with its regulation, I would have posited. That's the whole core of the allegation here.
We're going around in circles again. The fact that the agency says it so doesn't decide the constitutional question. There's a viable constitutional claim if I have entitled to protect my property interest through a process, and you say to me, I'm not going to let you do it.
But it gets to
I prove that is beside the point. There's no case that I can find that support. I see what you're trying to do with rationale. It's just irrelevant to me, like you're misusing Webster. There's no case that says we're not going to let you have your day on the constitutional claim. None. There's no case.
That proposition is not fatal to my position, Your Honor. The point is
she
that
she can't. You say on page 20 of your brief, she can't. The great irony in this case, you conceded it right there for me. I mean, when I read that, I thought that's what I was reading, and then on page 20, you confirmed what I understood. She has no possibility of getting a constitutional airing in this case. I can find no case to support that. None.
I think that
and it really is a pretty astonishing suggestion, and Webster does not support it. None of these cases support what you're saying.
The rationale of all of these cases support it, Your Honor.
Well, you know what? It's funny. You can say that, and it's interesting that you can have literally thousands of these cases, and all the results are inconsistent with what you're saying, and your argument to the contrary is the rationale doesn't support it.
I don't think they're inconsistent at all.
There is no case in which there has been a denial of an opportunity for a person to present their constitutional claim.
But there's no case going the other way, Your Honor. There's no case that says that. I mean, it's a hole in the case law.
That a person gets their day in court on the constitutional, it can't be foreclosed by regulation or statute. There are many, many cases that say that.
That are on all fours with this case? I'm not aware of that case.
Is there some case that's all on all fours with your ruling?
No, I think that that's why you need to look to the rationale of the other cases to fill in the gap. There are no other questions. I would ask the court to affirm judgment below.
Is there any remaining time? I thought you did have extra time.
I did reserve 2 minutes. Just trying to figure out where to start. This is not, in our view, this is not a Vitarelli challenge. In this case, Ms. Peavy never got the hearing. The process was never really invoked because she didn't get the hearing. It was through the surreptitious actions of the Postal Department that kept her from even getting the access to the very minor due process that she was due, but she is at least entitled to that due process. As the court has stated, this case is not like the moment. The Stedman case, nor is it like U.S. versus Fausto. The employee in Fausto was a term employee. He was hired in 1978 for a term not to exceed by the Department of Interior Fish and Wildlife Service for a period not to exceed September 30th, 1982. I believe in November 1980, he was informed by Fish and Wildlife that he was going to be terminated for various grievances, including unauthorized use of a vehicle. He was not at that time informed that he was entitled to the Department of Interior's grievance procedure. Mr. Fausto appealed to the MSPB and was informed that as a non-preference eligible except service employee, he had no right of appeal to the MSPB. And he was subsequently removed. However, someone on his behalf made an inquiry with Fish and Wildlife, and they reviewed his case based on that inquiry and reviewed the administrative file and determined that and gave him an opportunity to appeal his removal. And when he did that, they determined that all of the allegations against him were de minimis, I'm sorry, and that they did charge him with a 30-day suspension for unauthorized use of the vehicle. But without a hearing, they compensated him from the time when the 30-day suspension would have ended until the time the program that he was hired for ended. So he virtually received all that he was titled to as a term employee. Unlike Fausto, Ms. Peavy was a career employee with 23 years of service to her credit. Ms. Peavy deserves, as a 23-year employee, she was entitled to a hearing prior to being terminated. The Congress mandated that. It mandated that through the Postal Recovery Act, and all of the cases that I found, starting with Webster v. Doe, citing Johnson versus Robinson, which, as I said earlier, this case has followed in Ralpho versus Bell, Griffin versus FLRA, and Unger versus Smith. Ms. Peavy, again, does not have the benefit of the protections offered to competitive service employees under the Civil Service Reform Act. There is no clear and convincing evidence that Congress intended that she should be denied access to the only form of redress available to her. And as I've said earlier, this case is not controlled by Stedman, and as the court has said as well, nor is it controlled by Fausto, because she, unlike Fausto, was a 23-year employee with a property interest. She had a full expectation of retiring from the Postal Service, and that was denied her without so much as a hearing. And that is a clear violation of her constitutional due process rights. We would ask the court to remand this case to the district court to determine whether she is entitled to a hearing on whether a finding on whether or not she's entitled to a hearing prior to her termination.
All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Thank you both.
Thank you.